What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Thein Rosenbaum, author of the new book, Saving Free Speech from Itself. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shishinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. A week from tomorrow, the fun early spring holiday of Purim's coming up. Purim celebrates the events of the Book of Esther in the Bible, the salvation of the Jews from attempted destruction in Persia, first, but certainly not the last time that happened. The Jews are saved, the bad guys, especially Haman, are destroyed, and we drink and eat to celebrate, and everybody has a good time. While Purim is the silliest Jewish holiday, and in many ways the most fun, even adults dress up in costume, it is often neglected by adults as being, oh, just a kid's festival. That's a shame. Because the truth is, we need our religious life to be both serious and meaningful and fun, if not always at the same time. Judaism has always understood this and has incorporated into its annual calendar both the overwhelming seriousness of days like Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and the ridiculous frivolity of Purim, the Feast of Esther. And in a subtle way, it's chosen to make them polar opposites, twin festivals almost exactly 6 months apart, half a year, with completely reversed traditions and practices. The parallels, or rather the reversals, are fascinating. Beginning with the placement on the calendar, these include food, dress, music, and, of course, tone. On Yom Kippur, we fast. On Purim, we feast. On Yom Kippur, we are to be deeply serious. On Purim, we are to revel and be as silly as possible. On Yom Kippur, we dress all in white. On Purim, we dress in costumes of every color and construction. On Yom Kippur, we pray all day. On Purim, we perform plays and parodies, carnivals and celebrations, and play games of chance. On Yom Kippur, we are not to drink at all, not even water. On Purim, we're commanded to drink alcohol, ad lo yada, until we can't tell the difference between the evil Haman and the good Mordechai. On Yom Kippur, there's music of power and sanctity, like Kol Nidre. On Purim, there is, oh, today we'll merry, merry be. If holidays were human beings, Yom Kippur would be Mother Teresa. Purim would be, oh, I don't know, Charlie Sheen? These holidays could not be any more different and still be Jewish. Yet oddly, the mystics saw in Purim a similarity to Yom Kippur. They noted that Yom Kippur, called in Hebrew Yom HaKippurim, could be translated, if you were being very literal, as the day like Purim. And not only those mystical Kabbalists saw it this way, so did the noted anti-mystic, the Vilna Gaon. The reasoning of these great minds on the subject is certainly complex. One rabbi wrote, "We would assume Yom Kippur is the greater of the 2 days, but in one sense, Purim is even greater. It's easier to achieve spiritual elevation on a day like Yom Kippur, when we pray and have no time for forbidden activities like gossip or getting angry. By fasting, the soul achieves dominance over the body. But on Purim, in our state of rambunctious drunkenness, it's much harder to maintain human dignity." No kidding. As Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov wrote, "If one attains holiness through affliction, and another attains holiness through indulgence, who is the greater of the two? It may be said that the one who attains holiness through indulgence is greater, for the attainment of holiness through indulgence requires an infinitely greater degree of striving and effort." In this way, the challenge of Purim is greater. Literally translated, Yom HaKippurim is only a day like Purim. You know, like Purim. Well, frankly, I don't buy it. To me, Purim is much more a reflection that people need humor and joy at least as much as they need serious introspection. Purim is here to teach us that even the Holy Blessed One likes a good party now and then, like the other springtime festivals, whether we call it Mardi Gras, Spring Fling, Carnival, or Rodeo. Purim is a lot of fun, a great way to usher in the end of winter with a wild, over-the-top, rambunctious celebration. Inhibitions are out and revelry for one night and day is in. It's as though we've been good for so long, we need to let down our hair, change clothes, really celebrate. There's a 9-word summary, a famous one, of every Jewish festival from Hanukkah through Pesach. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. On Purim we add, and drink. Pure, irresponsible fun, right? But there's also something more profound going on at Purim than just a good, unwholesome time. There's a famous joke that says that on Purim, we Jews dress up and pretend to be non-Jews, while on Yom Kippur, we dress up and pretend to be Jews. Purim is here to remind us that Judaism, our own Judaism, your Judaism, can be, should be, enjoyable and meaningful. That being Jewish is a gift and a blessing, and it can be a rollicking good time. So no matter how old or young you are, or if you don't have or do have kids, come to Purim this year, like at my own synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, with a carnival next Sunday and Purim Megillah reading in wild celebration on Monday night, the 9th. Anyway, to play us in this morning, here's the Maccabees version of the Purim story, set to Jewish rock star Pink's appropriately named song, Raise Your Glass.
Stand for a tale so grand. Shushan is the place where it all began. The hidden miracle. One man, second in command. Slay all the Jews with his wicked plan. A scheme so miserable. He chose a day for the disaster. It's ironic what came after. He didn't know a girl named Esther would turn it upside down. So raise your glass if you can see the hidden meaning. It's right in front of you. We will never be, never be anything but proud to tell the story. Then of who? Won't you come on and come on and raise your glass? Became the queen, cause God was pulling strings from behind the scenes. She wore the royal crown. 3 days the Jews just prayed. Queen Esther risked her life, went to save the day. She took Haman down. The streets were filled with celebration. Everyone ate Haman Tashin. Jubilation for the nation. Kanti Elamu.
That was the Maccabees a cappella version of the Purim story, kind of. Raise your glass. Good advice on Purim to raise your glass. It's coming up March 9th and 10th. Our guest this morning, Thane Rosenbaum, is a legal scholar, law professor, novelist, and essayist. His new book is an important one on a crucial question these days. It's called Saving Free Speech from Itself. Meet him and find out the importance and dangers of free speech in America. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball,
enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is in our beautiful new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, in our own building near the entrance to the Foothills Mall area. Services, classes, and events are all ongoing. Join us this Friday night, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla. Our Tat Kabbalat Shabbat evening services are at 5:30 for families of very young children with a great oneg after. And our main Shabbat celebration services follow at 6:30 p.m. this Friday night. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Synagogue is at 2270 West Ina, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to Foothills Mall. Not in the mall, but in our own building outside of it. By the way, Purim is coming up fast. We have a special kids' carnival next Sunday from 10 to noon, and our world-class Megillah reading raucous celebrations Monday night, March 9th at 6:30 p.m. Don't miss it. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and wonderful array of adult education academy courses, including our new class in Life After Death and Jewish Belief, and, of course, all of our wonderful services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchatucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing synagogue in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Thane Rosenbaum is an extraordinary, I would say, nobody uses this term anymore, but man of letters, essayist, novelist, law professor. He has a new book out, Saving Free Speech from Itself, which is fascinating, deep, richly written. Also a prominent novelist. Good morning. Welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thanks for having me on your program.
I can't think of a subject that seems to, boy, hit the zeitgeist more importantly right now than your book about free speech. Free speech is often considered almost a divine right in America. Can you explain a little bit about what the First Amendment really says and what it means?
Well, thank you. It's filled with an enormous amount of confusion, but the First Amendment essentially says that the government cannot abridge, right? It's prohibited from doing the following things, right? So it has to, in the instance of speech, of course, we know it guarantees religion, freedom of the press, but the abridgment, the curtailment, specifically is reserved for speech. That government cannot be in a position that it impinges on citizens' or residents' speech, because the concern is that it's being done so to silence the content of what's being said, and that's how it's commonly understood. So, for instance, the First Amendment has nothing to do with two people getting in an argument and one of them cursing out the other one, and the other says, stop talking to me this way, and he says, well, I have a free speech right under the First Amendment. It doesn't work for that. It works because the government tries to stop you from doing something. Free speech is used as a defense if the government arrests you for speaking, doesn't grant you a permit to give your chance an opportunity to speak, stops you from sending a particular kind of message. And so since the 1960s, the free speech right of the First Amendment has been much, much more aggressive, right? Prior to the 1960s, it almost never came up, because the truth is, Rabbi, the founding fathers didn't care that much about speech. They cared about the press, and they cared about religion. Speech was an afterthought. Speech almost didn't even make it into the Constitution. If not for three states and their own state constitutions, neither Alexander Hamilton nor James Madison would have put it in. They put it in as an afterthought. And they always thought, this is the key thing in my book, Saving Free Speech from Itself, they always thought that speech is a right, yes, true, the government can't cancel it, true, but it is not a superseding right that violates the rights of other rights that citizens enjoy, for instance, the rights to peace and tranquility. So what we've seen is a lot, we've lost that sense of it. So that's why burning a cross on an African American's lawn is legal. Marching Nazis through Skokie, Illinois, where they have a high percentage of Holocaust survivors, perfectly legal. Burning a flag, or better yet, burning a flag in front of a family who lost a son fighting for the country, perfectly legal. Protesting at the funeral of a dead Marine with signs that says God hates fags, perfectly legal. I have just given you five major cases that don't make sense to Europeans who also have a free speech right, but in their sense, they don't allow free speech to trample over the dignity of other human beings.
I think it's an excellent explanation. That gets to the crux of one of the central arguments in your book, and we'll explore that in much greater depth when we come back with the quite brilliant Thane Rosenbaum in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There is a perception now in some parts of the Jewish world that Islam is incredibly hostile to Judaism and has always been so, that Jews live terribly in Muslim countries, and that Jews were exploited by Muslims wherever they were. That's not a terribly historically accurate picture.
Right. In fact, it's grotesquely inaccurate. And even today, in both Morocco and Tunisia, two Arab countries in North Africa, which used to be French colonies, there are Jews occupying cabinet-level positions as ministers.
Right.
And the king of Morocco recently consecrated X millions of dollars, but a huge sum of money, to restoring Jewish sites to their former glory, synagogues, cemeteries, schools, etc.,
old age
homes. Because Jewish heritage tourism, both from Israelis of Moroccan origin and from people in the rest of the world who just want to visit Morocco but do so as Jews, is a major source of income to the country. So in a way, the king's making an investment.
Yeah,
in
tourism
his
investment, in fact.
Tourist industry. But, okay, so maybe in the modern Arab world, these two countries are exceptional. But historically, Jews fared far better under Islamic rule than they did under Christian rule. And two very good examples of this are the southwestern corner of Europe, which today are Spain and Portugal, but basically the two countries of the Iberian Peninsula, which once were multiple kingdoms, Aragon, Castile,
Asturias, whatever, lots of places.
But there, Granada. When the Muslims arrived in 711, they didn't have enough literate people among them to govern the country or to keep the accounts. So they turned to their Jewish subjects, and these Jews rose in prominence to eventually occupy offices that were the equivalent today to minister of finance, even prime minister. They were often ambassadors.
There were even Jewish generals, actually, in Islamic countries.
So this... that's more true on the other end of Europe than in southwestern Europe. But this was a period that lasted to one degree or another from 711 to 1492, so well over 700 years. Now, it's true that the Christians started reconquering Spain in 1085 and pushed the Muslims further and further south. But the lands, the cities we think of as the bedrock of Sephardic Jewry, Cordoba, Granada, Sevilla.
Toledo.
Those, yeah. No, not Toledo.
Not Toledo.
No. Toledo was the city that was reconquered in 1085 and was early on returned to the Christians.
I see, okay.
No. The place is in Andalusia. But on the other end of the Mediterranean world, in the Balkans, in Greece, Bulgaria, all of the countries that used to be Yugoslavia, Romania to some extent, and the European part of Turkey, those places were ruled by the Ottoman Turks for at least 500 years, and Jews did very well. I mean, the city of Thessaloniki was run by Jews, and many of them were quite wealthy. So the idea that Jews never did well under Islamic rule is just utterly false. What is true is that after the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, many Arabs turned against their Jewish neighbors with whom they'd been friendly for centuries, and life became very tough. And within the next 20 years, if they didn't leave in the late 40s or the early 50s, after the Suez War, and even more so after the Six-Day War in 1967, they were virtually all gone. I mean, 99% of these Jewish communities have disappeared, and they went to various destinations, but they are no longer in the countries where they lived for centuries.
Well, thank you for that overview and really correcting that misperception. It's an important thing to address. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective segment. As Bernie Sanders' status as the frontrunner for the Democratic nomination for president has surged, so has concern among many Jews over his lukewarm perspective on Israel, the only Jewish country in the world. While Sanders once lived on a kibbutz in Israel, last week he refused to attend the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C., tweeting that the Israeli people have the right to live in peace and security, so do the Palestinian people. So far, no problem. But then he continued, I remain concerned about the platform AIPAC provides for leaders who express bigotry and oppose basic Palestinian rights. For that reason, I will not attend their conference. While AIPAC does not speak for all Jews in America, it certainly has an important place in the Jewish community here and bipartisan support. You can't say that Sanders isn't open about his feelings about Israel. Questioned about his choice to avoid AIPAC in the Democratic debate last week, Bernie Sanders said he would say to other Jews concerned about his choice, I am very proud of being Jewish, before he called Bibi Netanyahu a reactionary racist. The other Jewish candidate, Mike Bloomberg, will address AIPAC. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morty and Abe, who are not religious men really, are walking their dogs by the temple on Saturday morning. Morty says, let's go in. I hear they have great chopped liver at Kiddush every Shabbos. And Abe answers, they'll never let us go in with the dogs. So Morty says, just follow my lead. And to the temple he goes. The shamus, kind of a doorkeeper, stops him and says, no dogs allowed in the shul. And Morty answers, it's my seeing eye dog. And the shamus says, oh, okay, go in. Abe follows him, and again the shamus says, no dogs allowed in the shul. And Abe answers, it's my seeing eye dog. And the shamus says, this is your seeing eye dog? A chihuahua? And Abe says, those mumsers, is that what they gave me? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and be careful of those chihuahuas. We welcome our Shin Shinin, Danielle Levy and Shai Friedwald, young representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
It's March, which means Purim is coming, another week or so. One of my favorite holidays, the silliest Jewish holiday of all. So what do you guys do for Purim in Israel?
So in Ramat Gan, in my high school, we put Aman and we beat him really hard.
You beat him?
No, I'm kidding, I'm kidding.
Yeah, you just choose the kid you don't like the most.
Exactly,
and,
exactly.
Yeah, that's probably a bad
idea. Last year was shy, it's fine.
So, no, I'm kidding.
He hasn't been chosen more than three or four times, so it's all right.
So, we eat Amen Tashe and Ozne Aman in different kind of flavors.
By the way, that's a terrible name in Hebrew, the ears of Haman.
Right,
it's
right.
So much, Amen Tashe right. Sounds better, I'm sorry.
Right. What do you mean different types of flavors?
Chocolate,
limat
halav.
No, only
yes,
chocolate.
Exactly.
Only chocolate, oh my gosh. But no, you have to have man, you have to have apricot,
I'm
cherry.
For that. No.
That no, is not,
just chocolate, huh?
Yes.
Nutella? Nutella
is
very good.
Nutella, yeah. Yes. And I'm talking for myself, I really like to fancy costumes.
Yes,
like,
you dress well. Okay.
I made them. Like my mom.
You make your own costumes.
My mom makes them.
So your mom makes them for you. Let's be honest.
Right,
okay.
Yes. So last year, actually, if you know Netta Barzilai, she won the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah, the toy was her song, right?
Toy was her song.
So you went as Netta Barzilai?
Yes, but not as the toy clip because that was so obvious. And then she released a new song with called Basa Sababa, and she looked like a ballet dancer with a rhino. It was
with a rhino horn.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was
an interesting outfit. I remember that.
And I
So you dressed as
exactly.
He was beautiful.
Was he really gorgeous? Did you see pictures?
I saw pictures, videos, everything.
All right. So Danielle, what did you do for Purim besides eat chocolate hamantaschen?
Oh yeah. So for us, it's always a tradition at school. So I used to dress up with a friend from first grade until 11th, and not first grade, from seventh grade, because
seventh grade, okay.
That's when my school starts until the 11th grade.
Okay. You must have dressed up as little kids too, though. I mean,
sure,
kids love
but that's what my mom responsible for. And,
yeah, you didn't have to, you
and
didn't
I
come
don't
up,
take responsibility
well,
for it.
Well, of course, okay.
So from seventh grade until the 11th grade, I had one friend that we used to dress up, always the two of us. Sometimes it was more people joining us, but we were the core of it. I came up with the idea, and she made it happen, literally action-wise. And we had the best costumes ever, so we always made our own costumes. But then in 12th grade, it's a very special year because you dress up in your own village. So everyone in that village, at that settlement, Moshav, dress up together, everyone, if you're friends and if not. So it's tons of kids. So in my age group, we're 25 kids. So we dress all 25, and you make it really awesome. So we dressed up as pirates, and we built our own ship, and it was really awesome.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah. Did you rob people as part of this to, keep in costume and character?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So we also do in the streets big parties, in Tel Aviv, for example.
Even I go there.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's big parties.
You go in costume, you walk
you
around.
You go in costumes.
So last time I was in Israel for Purim, they were spraying silly string on everybody and bopping people on the heads with these things.
Yes, like that, Israeli hammers. And,
like the plastic hammers that make the noise.
And,
it was insane.
Yes.
Well,
yeah, it's crazy.
Sounds fun. You can tell us next week how you're going to dress up for Purim this year. This is a very, very important subject.
Okay.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank
we'll
you
talk
very
next.
Much.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Tetzaveh in the book of Exodus, which gives the first commandment to create a ner tamid, an eternal light for the tabernacle in the wilderness, first sanctuary of our people of Israel. We are told that there should be a continual fire, a constant light shining on the altar, a sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. That light is found today at every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or how grand the temple. The light burns always, reminding us that God is with us always, and we only need to be open to that presence in our own lives. Where is God? With us always, as the Ner Tamid symbolizes. And the light of that Ner Tamid can serve as a reminder to each of us of the sacred light, the Nitzutz Elohim, the spark of divine fire within each of us that needs only to be fanned into a flame to inspire us to work to create holiness in our everyday world. There's a beautiful, brief poem on the subject from the Hasidic mystical text, the Keter Shem Tov, translated by Barry Holtz and Art Green in Your Word is Fire. When you focus all your thought on the power of the words of prayer, you may begin to see the sparks of light that shine within them. The sacred letters are the chambers into which God pours God's flowing light. The lights within each letter, as they touch, ignite one another, and new lights are born. It is of this that the psalmist says, "Light is sown for the righteous, and joy for the upright in heart." If we are to preserve our own spark of sanctity, our personal Ner Tamid, we will need to resist the darkness that attempts to conquer us. But we will need as well to remember that there is something brilliant, bright, and holy within each of our souls. When we return, our guest, Thane Rosenbaum, will explain why free speech must be balanced by human dignity. Find out just how important that is when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
At a carnival procession in Spain, participants dressed like Nazis and Jewish concentration camp prisoners while dancing next to a float evoking crematoria. The Israeli embassy in Madrid protested the display that weekend at the annual carnival procession in Campo de Cripana, a town about 80 miles southeast of Madrid. "We condemn the vile and repugnant representation that disrespects the victims of the Holocaust," the embassy wrote, making fun of the murder of millions of Jews by the Nazis. "European nations must collectively fight anti-Semitism." A video of the procession shows participants marching in fake Nazi uniforms. Behind them, dancers wearing striped outfits evoking concentration camp uniforms followed, waving flags of Israel. They were followed by a float shaped like a train locomotive with two large chimneys. Also last week, a carnival procession in Aalst, Belgium, featured costumes of Haredi Orthodox Jews depicted as ants. Dozens of other participants wore fake hook noses based on Jewish stereotypes. One group of participants wore shiny black uniforms and red armbands evocative of Nazi uniforms. A third group, dressed as Jews, carried a sign that warned readers not to tell the truth about the Jew. Last year, UNESCO dropped the Aalst Carnival from its list of World Heritage events over the depiction of Jews in the 2019 procession. That one featured a float with effigies of grinning Haredim holding bags of money and one with a rat on its shoulders. The group that created the float said it was meant to protest the rising cost of living. And, you know, of course, to blame it on the Jews.
This is not murder. This is mitzvah.
The new Amazon Prime TV show, The Hunters, is making news, both good and bad. The premise is that a diverse team of American investigators, well, almost vigilantes, are working together in New York City in 1977 to capture or kill escaped Nazis who are plotting to create a Fourth Reich. starring Al Pacino and a number of Jewish actors, including Saul Rubinek, Logan Lerman, and Carol Kane, among others. The dramatization is very loosely based on famous Nazi hunters like Simon Wiesenthal, Beata Klarsfeld, and others. The controversy has come because of the way the creator and showrunner, David Weil, grandson of a survivor who developed the show as a testament to her, and the team of mostly Jewish writers have fictionalized the Holocaust, inventing incidents and events. The Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum in particular criticized the way the things that never occurred were placed there, and the way Auschwitz was used as a setting for a fictional game of human chess, in which the Jewish prisoners used in the game were executed as their pieces were captured. It's a mostly well-made show, but clearly polarizing in how it depicts the Shoah. It follows last year's interesting and idiosyncratic Holocaust film, Jojo Rabbit, which won its writer-director star, Taika Waititi, also known as Taika Cohen, an Oscar, while also provoking quite different responses from viewers. I think both the show Hunters and Jojo Rabbit are well worth seeing and deciding for yourself. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, Thane Rosenbaum, our guest. He has a new book out, Saving Free Speech from Itself. He is a lawyer, legal professor, author, novelist. I was first introduced to him through some articles in various publications, and then his wonderful novel, The Golems of Gotham. His book focuses, as we discussed earlier, on the question of the First Amendment, what constitutes free speech, but also whether that can be balanced. You mentioned that in Europe, of course, they do have the concept of free speech. It's a right throughout Europe. But in France, they also created the concept of human dignity, which isn't necessarily something in our Constitution. Can you explain about the balance there and how we respond to those?
Well, it's actually worse than that, Rabbi. Dignity is a word that doesn't exist in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. It's not there. For all the rights that we receive, the rights to respect, mutually respect each other, no, that's not there. In fact, I would argue that the pursuit of happiness, right, which Thomas Jefferson put into the Declaration of Independence, is the exact opposite of that, because pursuit is such an aggressive word. It suggests that I'm pursuing my own happiness regardless of its effect on you. That's my right, and get out of my way. So, no, the Europeans simply don't do this. For them, dignity always matters. How one treats individuals, protecting people from humiliation, disrespect, disregard, they understand it as to be able to live in a society with a real true sense of equality means that you don't spend your days seeing signage that says you have no right to exist, or try to stamp out your citizenship. So, the Germans, even more so, because their constitution was written after the Holocaust, so it's just loaded with dignity language. But certainly the French have it too, the UK has it, and yes, they also have the right to free speech. Yes, they do. But not if it tramples upon the dignity of other human beings. And so, for instance, in Austria or Germany, neo-Nazis want to march, they march you right to jail. In France, there is a shock comic, Dudonné, whose part, his act is he gets up there, nightclubs, and he says, don't you think we should gas the Jews again? In fact, here, let me give you the names of some Jews we should gas. He goes straight to jail. He would be a smash in the United States, Dudonné. If he ever moved here, we'd love him. And we would say, of course he has a First Amendment right to talk about bringing back gas chambers. In the book I tell this this really wonderful little anecdote. If anyone saw The Wolf of Wall Street, the hedonism of these Wall Street boiler room brokers, there's this really ugly scene where they're tossing dwarves into a dart, like treating dwarves as if they're darts. There is a law, Rabbi, in France that absolutely prevents this to do anything like this to dwarves, to mishandle them, to throw them. There's actually a law. which means that even if a dwarf wanted to do it, he couldn't because it's too...
It's a violation of the law because it violates human dignity, a concept
yes,
that we
exactly.
just don't really have.
Which you don't.
So I think some of us were raised thinking that that great line about, you know, my right to free speech doesn't include shouting fire in a crowded theater. Can you explain the limitations there?
Good point. So that's what we always invoke, right? And, of course, there's a public self-safety issue there, right?
Right.
Of course, you could yell fire in an empty theater.
Sure.
But you'd be an idiot. But you could do that.
But there's no law against being an idiot in America. I think we're very clear on that.
Yes, we're very clear on that, Rabbi. So, yes, we have some a narrow set of exceptions to this rule. And the many of which are included in a very famous Supreme Court case, Chaplinsky versus the United States. And it sort of lists them, libel and defamation, although frankly in the United States it's much harder to win a libel and defamation case than it is in Europe. Obscenity is another. Fighting words, right, which has not been used to the extent that I think it should have been, which in the book I talk about the ways in which to revive the fighting words doctrine that comes out of that case. There's another case, Brandenburg versus Ohio, talks about the incitement of imminent lawlessness, meaning I can't whip up an audience to go kill somebody or to go, you know, burn a cross and say I had a free speech right to do that. Even if I didn't show up to the cross burning and I went home and just ate something, if I get arrested, I can't claim a First Amendment right if I'm inciting
people to violence or to lawlessness
right.
in
again,
the larger sense.
Right. And by the way, the shouting fire is the same idea, right? We don't want people, you know, trampling over each other. It's about violence. It's never, Rabbi, about dignity. If you'll notice, all of those exceptions are not about dignity. Libel and defamation is because you're materially damaged. Your reputation has been damaged. Your business has been damaged, right? It's not about your psyche, your mental health, your physical health. And as you know, because you read the book so well, the book is filled with the new science, the neuroscience of the physical and mental effects of humiliation and indignity and disrespect. It's significant. It's not just mental or psychological damage. It leads to physical sickness. My favorite quote in the book, Rabbi, is from Lyndon Johnson, who said, a man has the right to go outside of his home and not be humiliated in front of his children.
Yeah. It's a powerful argument. I want to go to the... You can't really set aside human dignity, but you also make an interesting point about... an important point about the internet, about the social media, the kind of incitement that really is an incitement to violence, the radicalization that's available. That's free speech, and the internet is kind of crazy about free speech. You mentioned that people like Julian Assange and Snowden are heroes to the online community. How do we deal with issues like this?
Well, yet again, here's another example where the Europeans are far more advanced. We are First Amendment crazy. People who are First Amendment absolutists or crazy, to my mind, are the same people that make fun of Second Amendment crazies or absolutists, right? They say the same argument. The Second Amendment absolutist says, if you come take my deer rifle, the next thing you know, if you take away my assault weapon, the next thing you know, you'll take away my little deer rifle. And that's their argument for the Second Amendment. And First Amendment absolutists are in the same way. If you stop me from saying anything, the next thing you know, you'll arrest me for calling to criticize the government. The Europeans don't do this. You know, in the United States, Anwar al-Awlaki, his sermons were available on YouTube, and it led directly to the Boston Marathon killings, the act of terror, as well as the terrorism at Fort Hood. Major Assange was watching these videos. The Arsarnaev brothers learned how to make a bomb in their kitchen within a bomb instruction video. The Europeans don't allow this. And yes, the online community is equally rabid in other Western societies about the freedom of the net, but the governments have responsibilities to protect the people. And so there's something almost it's lunacy to think that we should be protecting the rights of people who are indoctrinating people online into terror, recruiting them online into terror, teaching them how to make bombs online, all under the pretense that this is what our founding fathers thought. Now, in the book, I oftentimes have this thought experiment, Rabbi, where I say, we should just ask ourselves, what would George Washington do or say? And do you really think that George Washington, the general of the colonial army, would think that that's the First Amendment, was to allow terrorists to build bombs in their kitchen and kill people at the Boston Marathon and have 50 people lose their legs? Really? You really think that that's what George Washington thought of? By the way, do you really think that George
Patriots
Washington
Day,
thought...
On Patriot's Day, by the way.
Yes, exactly, on Patriot's Day. Thank you, Rabbi. But do you really think that the Founding Fathers actually thought, but specifically George Washington, that you should burn the American flag in front of a family that lost their son in battle? Really? You really think that's what he understood it meant? Again, it was an afterthought. It was supposed to be subordinated to press and religion. They were very felt strongly that there should be a newspapers to be critical of the government. And by the way, that's the point. Their understanding of free speech was to criticize the policies of the government, to participate in representational democracy. That's what they thought speech was. They did not think speech was to be used as a weapon so the Nazis can essentially attack Jews living in Skokie, Illinois. No, they never thought that, or that you could burn crosses in front of African Americans. It was intended to be able to have... Remember, we were brain damaged from King George III. So all of our amendments are there to respond to the things that he did, right? The Fourth Amendment, unlawful searches and seizures. Yes, the soldiers of the United Kingdom would come into your home and start ransacking you or arresting you. And speech was, there was sedition everywhere. You could say anything about the king. So they were very meticulous and fastidious about this one idea: allow our citizens to criticize our government. This idea of using words to wound and as weapons is not something they factored into at all. This is something that we developed after the 1960s.
We do hear about people that get in all kinds of trouble because they use words that are considered damaging. Is that because free speech doesn't, as you said, people get fired, people get sued, people are called abusive for using phrases, any phrase, certain specific phrase can't be stated. Is that an abridgment of free speech? I mean, I'm a little confused on this.
Yes, exactly. And that's what the book is saying. It's saying, look, we're hypocrites. We curtail speech all the time. In the book, I pointed out a software engineer at Google was fired for writing an internal memo in which he was trying to explain the reasons for why women don't advance in engineering firms. And he associated it with some kind of, not just a social inequality, but something else that may have been construed as insulting women. He was fired the very next day. He thought, it's Google. There's a bunch of geniuses here. I can raise this idea. But he couldn't. This is not even a college campus. Donald Sterling used to own...
Yeah, the Clippers, right?
The Los Angeles Clippers. I found this shocking. He had a mistress, many people remember this, considerably younger, who took some photos of her with some of his players and posted it on Instagram. She was so happy. He was three times her age. She lived in a condo he paid for. She was driving a Ferrari, I think, what he paid for. He was very upset with her. She was recording his call, and he used the N-word in connection with some of his team.
His players on his team.
And they forced him to sell the team. This is a private communication. It was not intended for the general public at all. It was said in the context of a spat between a mistress and a person who felt that, you know, he felt in some ways insulted, and he felt that he'd been doing enough for her, that this is not something that she should, you know, do without regard to his feelings. You know, it's astounding, right? The Colin Kaepernick and the NFL players that want to take a knee, what about their free speech rights, right? We're obviously, the fans that decided that they were going to boycott the NFL unless the players stand at attention to the playing of the American flag, how come they don't think that the players have free speech? And, you know, why aren't you just going, you know what, the hell with them? If they want to take a knee, the hell with them. This country lets them do it. Now, the truth is, remember what I said at the beginning, Rabbi. The First Amendment is not invoked unless the state stops you. If the owner of the team stops you, it's his team. If he wants you to dress, you know, in drag, you can dress. That's his team. If that's the contract. If he wants you to wear a suit to the airport, but he wants you to stand at attention at the playing, that's his team. And that's what happened, actually, with the Dallas Cowboys, where he told his team, I'm going to fine you or not play you, because the fans don't like it. Now, where this would have come in for the First Amendment is if the state of Texas passed a law that said at all events, public events, the playing of the national anthem requires the person to stand. Then the government is controlling speech, but a private enterprise can do it without violating the First Amendment. But I'm talking about a broader principle. If you really, really believe in free speech, why not let them kneel?
I want to thank Thane Rosenbaum. I feel we've already gone way over time. I feel like I could keep going. The book is called Saving Free Speech from Itself. Where can people go to find out more about you and about the book?
Well, I have a website, ThaneRosenbaum.com. The book, of course, it will be available March 17th, but you can pre-order it on Amazon now, and all of your local bookstores can certainly acquire it as well, and there'll be an audio version of it as well if you listen to books in the car.
As so many people do, and I never got to ask you, where does a Jewish guy get the name Thane?
Well, you know, I spoofed that a little in one of my other novels, which was Secondhand Smoke,
right?
Because in that case, the main character's name was Duncan Katz. And that, for those Shakespeare fans, know that Thane is out of Macbeth.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Thane of Cawdor.
Right, Thane of Cawdor.
Was a title, the Thane of Cawdor.
And Duncan is the previous king.
The
so,
king.
Yes, of
That's
course,
right.
Who he kills.
So, yeah, and so that there's three nurses in that novel.
You were fated to be literary. You had no choice.
Yes, my parents were obviously putting me in. It was an odd Jewish name for sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest on Two Jewish Get a Final Musical Play Out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Stanley Davids, author of the new book, Deepening the Dialogue, Jewish Americans and Israelis Envisioning the Jewish Democratic State. Our play out this morning comes from Uri Davidi and his song, Muchanim. We are ready. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week we pray of peace.
כל יום מתפללים, מבקשים מן השמיים שאני אעבור. רק צריך להאמין ולפתוח עיניים, כי אני כבר פה. עוד מצווה אחת קטנה, תפילה עם לב פתוח, ויבוא הקץ. זה לקח אלפי שנה, הנה זה כבר בטוח, תנו להיכנס. ולא, לא, לא יהיו יותר דמעות
רק תראו ניסים ונפלאו.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.